My name is Patricia Kathleen, and this podcast series will contain interviews I conduct with female and female-identified entrepreneurs, founders, co-founders, business owners, and industry gurus. These podcasts speak with women and women-identified individuals across all industries in order to shed light for those just getting into the entrepreneurial game, as well as those deeply embedded within it. Histories, current companies, and lessons learned are explored in the conversations I have with these insightful and talented powerhouses. The series is designed to investigate a female and female-identified perspective in what has largely been a male-dominated industry in the USA to date. I look forward to contributing to the national dialogue about the long overdue change of women in American business arenas, and in particular, entrepreneurial roles. You can contact me via my media company website, wild.agency, that's wilde.agency, or my personal website, patriciakathleen.com. Thanks for listening. Now let's start the conversation. Hi, everyone, and welcome back. This is Patricia, and I am so excited to be sitting down today with Rachel Eva. Rachel is the founder and CEO of Standard Spoon Barware. So welcome, Rachel.
Thank you for having me.
So it's Standard Spoon Barware.
Barware, yes. Standard Spoon Barware.
I'm excited to get into that with you. A quick roadmap, you guys. For those of you listening and wanting to know where the interview is going to be headed today, we're going to talk with Rachel about her academic history and professional life following academics, what exactly Standard Spoon is, what it does, and what stage it is in, and goals that it has for the next 3 years with scaling, genre, all of those things included. And then we will wrap up with advice that Rachel has for other entrepreneurs out there in the same boat or people who are really interested in picking her brain. So Rachel, will you drop us just straight into your academic background and your professional life following academics?
Sure, thanks Patricia. So from a young child, I was really interested in art, and that was something that my parents encouraged with me. My early identity was as an artist. It was something that everyone saw I was very good at, and I took that up and I decided to like take that flag and carry it forward. And so when I went away to school, I studied it at the University of Pittsburgh. My initial pursuit was a dual degree in fine arts and English literature.
Okay.
So I come from a very like creative, storytelling is really important to me. Visual aesthetics are very important to me.
Yeah.
And I was very fortunate to have a family that supported me in those things.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, I did come from like a military family. We didn't have a lot of means growing up. So I went off to Pittsburgh and I signed my student loan papers and carried that financial burden ahead of me as well. Mm-hmm. And after two Pittsburgh winters and a study abroad that I did a semester at sea, which is when you are on a ship for a semester and you travel around the world.
Wow.
And that really opened my eyes to a lot of things. One about like consumptive practices of Americans.
Yeah.
But then also of all the beautiful things that were out there. And it was hard for me to then return. I had a huge culture shock incident. And so I actually just dropped out. I just failed to register for the fall semester.
Yep.
I returned home and I eventually completed my degree in English. So okay. I ended up dropping the fine art portion, because I realized I didn't really want to pursue a traditional path in terms of an artist and going the gallery route. I tried it for a little bit and it's a difficult model,
mm-hmm.
Especially for someone who wants to see things happen faster.
Yeah, it's antiquated, definitely.
So I have ended up finishing my degree at, I think, two or three different schools and getting it online. And I had to that was one of those things I had to give up, was the idea of having a degree from a four-year university.
Right.
I actually almost didn't even finish college, mm-hmm. because I didn't necessarily see the value in it with the path that was starting to unveil itself to me. But I'm one of those people that I just had to finish it in order to check the box to get it done.
Sure.
So we did that. Let's see, academically, that ended up kind of petering out, and I'm glad I stuck with it though. I studied a lot of literature during those days, a lot of magical realism, which is really
wow
interesting. It's this blending of reality and storytelling in a way that assumes the story is real, assumes the fantasy is real.
Yeah.
And it's just a really creative way to look at, and I've used that as a creative way to look at problems. It's a creative way to tackle challenges that I've encountered since then.
It's a huge genre in literature that's kind of opened up as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I'm so glad it's taken up speed. It's beautiful.
So did your professional life start to occur simultaneously with achieving your degree once it kind of metamorphosized into the online obtaining? Did you start kind of your occupational or professional career during that time?
Yes. So after I dropped out of school, I ended up just, I came back to home, which is San Diego, and I got a temp job. Mm-hmm. So I just did administrative work. I said, I know how to type well. I know how to use all these tools. And I ended up finding a position at the San Diego Airport Authority in their risk management department.
Wow.
Very different.
Diverse, yeah.
Very different place than I thought
it
was going in.
Sounds like a lot of rules attached to that particular position.
It was a great company, and I'm really glad I had that experience. I had spent 7 years there, moving from admin all the way up to like risk analyst position. And so it was fantastic training in terms of how to position my creativity in the context of something that's a little bit more strategic and analytical.
Right.
And so the finance portion and the risk management portion, which have served me very well since then. But it wasn't necessarily a complete match. During that time, as I was working in that environment, I was also an artist on the side. Mm-hmm. And I was intently pursuing that, not necessarily intending to make it into my profession, but in order to achieve a lot of vocational satisfaction.
Yeah, what kind of medium do you deal with?
I did printmaking and I did painting. I was all over the place.
Nice.
And the place where I got was at one point after I got married, my husband's also an artist. We were doing large scale installation artwork. And so we were installing art at hospitals and public spaces.
Nice.
And kind of getting into the design concept and fabrication. And we also had a lot of work that we did, handwork, that brought me a lot of satisfaction, but it was so difficult to try to think about how I was going to continue to turn this passion into something that was profitable.
Mm-hmm.
And rather than make compromises with my art in order to scale that into profitability, my husband and I started thinking about, like, what can we do instead of that, almost to protect the art, which was this sacred space of creativity.
Right.
And at the same time, not continue to live this dual life of, like, risk management by day and artist by night.
Right, yeah. So how did that navigate? How did that kind of come to fruition?
We had sort of an aha moment, I did specifically, which was when I realized that in order to scale my business as an artist, I would have to productize my art.
Right.
And rather than do that, we decided, let's just come up with a product then. And so we started down this rabbit hole trail of what can we create that we can then scale. And that was sort of the first scratching of that entrepreneurial itch. Mm-hmm. And we came at it from a very, like, very uneducated state.
Did you just sit down and say, well, what do we like to do?
We did.
What are we into?
We did.
What do we do with our
spare time?
We
started with our interests. Yeah. We started with our interests. Some of the early ideas, he was and still is to a certain degree a hairdresser. And so we're talking about products for the hairdressing and the beauty industries.
Sure, that's a good one.
We started with partway through ideation on like a scheduling tool that hairdressers could use to try to like solve some of those problems that he was experiencing in the field. My favorite failed idea was a tea company that was a blend of teas that had nootropic effects, and so they would actually help stimulate creativity and energy.
Oh, wow.
Without being like actual microdosing of drugs or something like
right.
that.
Right.
Super clean. And then it was that rich, like the ritual of having tea and having that be not like a mindfulness thing, but as but also a an actual
product, an actual substance.
Yeah, something that would actually like make an impact bio, like biochemically on your brain.
Right.
We didn't go down that route.
Yeah.
So
the favorite non-past ideation.
It was
ideation.
My favorite non-past idea.
Yeah.
And so we ended up with a cocktail tool that was an idea that was sort of presented to us by a friend as we were sitting around having cocktails. We were really into the foodie and the cocktail scene. Mm-hmm. And sitting down, it was at the time when, you know, the craft cocktail renaissance was really starting to stir in cities outside of New York and San Francisco and Chicago. And there was like two craft cocktail bars here in San Diego. We were visiting a friend in Seattle and chatting with some of the bartenders and just really appreciating the beauty of the craft of this cocktail.
Yeah.
And the way that bartenders were approaching their craft the way that I would approach a work of art.
Right.
And so there was certainly like vision alignment there, but also an appreciation for the work that they are doing. Our art, sort of our art collaborative before that was called Work of My Hands. And so it's this concept of like there's beauty and there's value to doing something when you're just, you're working with your hands and you're making something with your own, your physical body.
Right.
And so that craft that we saw the bartenders performing, it just hit a vein there, which was appreciation for this very ritualistic type of activity that brought pleasure and celebration.
Yeah.
So we had an idea. And we then took it to Kickstarter.
And
so that was the first idea that made it past our ideation stage.
Uh-huh. Did
and
you
actually
take it
went
to
like proof of concept.
Okay. So
I don't want to jump ahead.
No, not at all. So I want to hear about, well, let's talk about what it was. If it's different now, we can talk about the differences. But
sure.
What is Standard Spoon barware?
Standard Spoon barware is in a state of change right now. Mm-hmm. So it started out as a, and the name says it, it's a product-based company. We tested two bar spoons. That's where it came from. One was a very innovative new design. It was originally patented in the 1950s, which was a spinning bar spoon. And so you could, for people who didn't have the skill of a bartender to use the appropriate technique to move a spoon through a cocktail in a mixing glass, which is very different than just like sticking a spoon in and jostling through the ice. It's a very fluid motion if you ever mm-hmm. have sat at the bar and watched the old fashioned being made. And so this tool was one that would essentially help you stir a cocktail without necessarily needing to spend hours practicing doing it. And so it was a self-spinning spoon. You'd grab it and you'd just start stirring. And it was called the Wingman cocktail spoon because
okay.
it's your wingman in the bar.
Yeah.
And it was sort of pitched to the home cocktail enthusiasts, but also to bartenders who deal with a lot of occupational restraint, people who are doing like super high volume at bars and they just need
sure.
to not think so much. It improves like consistency of dilution. So it was very, very much a product focused launch. Like we have this beautiful product. We did another spoon called the Arrow Cocktail Spoon, which is a straight-handled bar spoon that's made as one piece that won't come apart. And so that solved the problem of bar spoons just breaking in the bar in front of customers.
So you did a Kickstarter. Was it successful?
It was.
Mm-hmm. And did it get you through to manufacturing? Or did you have, I'm assuming you had a sample or a prototype of some sort made up. And did
we
the
did,
Kickstarter
yes.
get you to your first round of manufacturing?
Yes. So that was, we were interested in making it, but we wanted to prove the concept and raise the funds in order to mitigate our risk.
Mm-hmm.
There's that background coming up.
Yeah.
So we, our goal was 15,000. I think we brought in like 17.
Okay,
during
great.
A 30-day campaign when we knew like we were so green and we knew no one in the industry. And that was very validating. And then we had to figure out how to make a product. And that was a huge learning experience as well.
Right. And how much, and you know, to sink into. That's a large part of what I want to get into about manufacturing. I've had a lot of conversations with startups who have products. You know, that there is a very delicate balance there that you can kind of go under if you don't keep your wits about you and keep your sights set. So you launched it, you Kickstarted it, you got your Kickstarter capital, you go back in to do it. The idea came about from hanging out with friends in Seattle and looking and seeing the equipment and the tools and kind of the beautiful hands and body of making a drink, which then itself becomes another body, which then itself is consumed by a third body, which, you know, if you look at things in that way, as an art historian, I'm like, that's an interesting concept. But so you say that it was the craft cocktail scene is just coming on. When I looked at your site, when I first looked at your company, I thought, I wonder how that marriage was happening because the craze took over, right? It was about a few years ago for me anyway. It was, like you said, in the larger, more metropolitan cities, and now in Idaho, you can find a craft cocktail bar, and it's
changed. Every cool restaurant has a craft cocktail.
And it's trickled, as it always does in American industry and society, into the home. So this has become, for me anyway, you know, you talk about your customer being even behind the bar at a bartender, but for me, this is like a gimme for people really developing their craft cocktail. I mean, craft cocktail books are everywhere. Everyone's doing parties at home with them. So it feels like, did at this point when you got your Kickstarter money, had you defined your client? Was it solely like in the industry of bars, or was it also the individual at home?
So you've nailed like our current transition right now. So when we first started, we were designing barware that immediately any bartender, any cocktail, and like crazy cocktail enthusiasts. I'm not talking about someone who likes to, you know, occasionally blend up a margarita at home, but the person who has 50 bottles at their home bar.
Yeah.
And already has a collection of like five jiggers. The professional bartender, the super serious cocktail nerd would immediately look at our tools and see how they were differentiated against all the existing products. And so we differentiated in terms of design. We're not interested in making anything that already exists. If it already exists, great. But there's no innovation, there's no creativity in that product for us. And so that's the artist in us speaking.
Right.
I want to do something new. The other thing is that they have to be beautiful. So many of our tools are just functional, especially in the bar space, where bartending used to be the thing that you did to get you through college, and now there are incredibly talented men and women devoting their lives to the craft.
Right.
And spreading joy and cheer and hospitality with every cocktail that they make, which I love. And so, and these people deserve to have tools that are worthy of that experience.
Right.
And we'll talk about that experience in a little bit too. And then the third thing was just uncompromising in terms of integrity and quality made goods, because we very much stand against the manufacturing concepts of planned obsolescence, where things are manufactured, intentionally designed in order to break down so that you will then repurchase them.
Right.
And so that sort of conscious consumerism, making things the way with integrity and to last. And so we take a lot of that, the design sense back from like the 30s and the 40s and the 50s, like the great days of American manufacturing when things were made, like built to be in your family forever.
Yes.
So yes, we were very much a product focused company, and we found a lot of our early and most of the people that are just diehard fans of ours come at us from that place of saying, thank you. I've been needing this for years. You finally made the thing. Like, you've made the best jigger that we could ever ask for.
Right.
And so we come at it from that place of like product excellence, but.
And that defines your, I mean, okay, so that's defining your niche kind of customer.
That was
that excellence, someone really in search of that.
And so that was our original like core group of customers that we were after. And as we've grown and as the cocktail revolution has continued to progress, more and more of our customers started becoming people who are interested in making cocktails at home. They'd seen beauty, they've experienced this ritual of the cocktail in the bar. You know, I go and I have this amazing experience.
Right.
Fresh ingredients, incredible garnishes, beautiful hospitality, presentation. I have, it improves the time that I'm spending with my friends and my family. It's this ritual of celebration and excellence. And then starting to want to maybe recreate that at home in more intimate spaces for other celebrations and intentions and parties and hangouts. Mm-hmm. And sometimes just because you as a person appreciate the beauty of a certain kind of experience.
So how does that play into the manufacturing? I mean, when you talk mm-hmm. about getting into, with that elite niche group, you're dealing to materials and things that push your bottom line from the manufacturing standpoint up a bit, I would assume.
Yes.
From any product standpoint.
Oh,
so
yes.
So how, when you mm-hmm. started navigating that, did you know what materials you wanted to build it out of and who was going to design it? I talked with someone who had just developed a medical device, and she said, listen, you know, the reason why manufacturing is such a game of sweating it out in the beginning is once you hit go, it'll rob the bank to change mm-hmm. anything, even where you put a number on it. You know, it's everything has got to be just so. And so it takes a great deal of consideration. When you were doing your manufacturing, did you find it to be the same? And since you're dealing with this kind of elite group, did you interview them or kind of test them for what they were looking for, or did you just come mm-hmm. up with it yourself?
Mm-hmm. That's one of the things that we love about the way that we launch products, and we have since done another 2 crowdfunding campaigns. So every time we launch a new significant product in our line, we've historically done that via crowdfunding. And the purpose for that is, one, to make sure that we're testing the right thing and this is something that people want, but also we then incorporate a lot of feedback from our customers
right.
during that campaign and then also throughout the manufacturing process. Uh-huh. And it really has served to inform the way that we make our tools. So our initial design, usually we interview tons of people in the industry, because if you're a bartender and you're making 200 old fashions a night, you're going to know where the weaknesses are in your tools or in
right.
your process. And so we start with that expertise to design the initial concept, and then we bring it forward to our community. And so in a sense, it's there's a little bit of community influence design there. When we did our last product, which is a remake of a vintage Napier jigger with quite a few improvements, we brought that forward to our group. We said, we want to remake this beautiful tool. We were looking to make the best jigger that fills the void of what we need right now. And there are a lot of jiggers which are measuring cups for measuring accurate amounts of liquid.
Right.
There were a lot of those on the marketplace that, do very well for certain kinds of techniques for measuring. But there wasn't a great graduated or stepped jigger that had multiple measurements on one side. And we found a design that we loved. It also was from that era that just communicated that the virtue of old school, like quality made goods.
Yeah, it's beautiful on your website.
Thank you. And we added functionality as a result of these interviews with the core group of customers, those crazy enthusiasts and the bartenders, to add internal markings for measurements that weren't represented in the jigger. For them to drop the handle on a version to make it more industry friendly, because the handle is beautiful and I personally like using it, but it's not super functional or realistic in a high volume setting.
Right.
And so certain things like this. And then when we brought it to, so then we designed that in advance, and then when we brought it to Kickstarter in the community, we got a ton more feedback from people in terms of, are you going to make one in milliliters for the rest of the world? Which we ended up doing. That we ended up
nice.
Adding that as like a stretch goal. And you have to be careful with those, because it's a delicate balance between incorporating customer feedback and helping that to inform your design process, but mm-hmm. then also being aware of scope creep and how much things are going to cost.
Absolutely. I mean, making everyone happy from the get-go will bankrupt anybody.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You got to prioritize mm-hmm. those demands and wants mm-hmm. at any rate.
And that speaks to another question you have about like the materials and what was our approach to that. We realized from the beginning we were not going to be able to please everyone. Mm-hmm. And rather than try to, and we also understood that we were not, a giant company that already exists that just wants to add a line of barware to the collection of like 1,000 kitchen tool SKUs. And so we didn't have those resources to work with, and we also don't have the resources, and we knew we were going to be learning about you know, efficiencies in manufacturing. We knew we were probably going to be making some mistakes along the way. And so we didn't try to compete in terms of price.
Right.
And we said, we're not going to try to compete in terms of like being in that same space because we'll lose. Mm-hmm. And so we're going to focus on making, on what our strength is, which is being a small design team, obsessive about designs, not needing necessarily to like justify the bottom line to a large corporation. And so how can we design the best tool?
Right.
And not compromise on those items of quality, because I don't need to sell, you know, 5 million of these.
No, and I think that thoughtfulness and, you know, powerful design and materials well made will trump saving a couple bucks any day of the week, mm-hmm. especially mm-hmm. in our very blessed, you know, environment of the mm-hmm. United States at any rate.
And so, if we're going to make a tool that a lot of our tools come with a lifetime guarantee, so if it ever breaks, right. we'll replace it.
It's a different market.
Do you want to buy something for $3 and replace it every 6 months, or do you want to buy something for $35 and have it for life?
For life.
And that's just, we had to identify that we're not even going to try to please the people who want cheaper goods. We're going to please the people who are happy to reward you for making the thing that they've been wanting that no one is willing to make.
Yeah, and then you can really focus on what you want to, mm-hmm. which is the function and design of it. Sounds mm-hmm. like that's where your heart is. Mm-hmm. How? So when was it launched? When was Standard Spoon Barware like launched? And where are you at right now in the process? Mm-hmm. Have you received funding? And then on the other side of all three of those, what do the next 3 years look like for
sure.
you?
Sure. And when I say we, my husband is my co-founder, so that's an important thing. Like, we're a team, and mm-hmm. we wouldn't have made it doing it on our own.
Right.
For sure. And we intentionally grew the business a little slower part-time. So we initially launched our first product in 2014 and did not bring it to market until 2015, about 15 months later. Mm-hmm. It took that long to figure out manufacturing and quality control and all that sort of thing.
Right.
And so that's the initial timeline. We did another campaign in 2016 to release a mixing glass and two muddlers, a maple muddler and an ebony muddler, mm-hmm. which is like probably the most luxurious high-end muddler you can ever find anywhere.
Nice.
And then in 2017, oh gosh, it was 2017, we launched the Napier Jigger campaign and delivered that end of last year.
Okay.
So
you're about 4 or 5 years in.
4 or 5 years in, mostly working part-time, because there's a lot of waiting with the manufacturing. And then there was a lot of waiting in order to build up a product line. So we intentionally decided to build one tool at a time, or one or two tools at a time, mm-hmm. in order to really focus on getting it right. A lot of people, a lot of the barware lines, when you'll see a set out there, like someone will come out with a new set and it'll be branded by this bartender or this one. And quite a few of them do a good job, but often you can run into challenges where you're trying to release the whole set, and so you'll make compromises with a few things that aren't lining up. And we didn't want to do that. So one tool at a time, an intentional investment period of product development, mostly self-funded and funded by Kickstarters. We did get a small business loan, which helped with some of the manufacturing costs just to supply inventory. Mm-hmm. And having done a successfully crowdfunded campaign was great justification.
It's great for the resume.
It's really wonderful
for everyone to see as a, you know, mm-hmm. as a business founder, as a lot of things. I think people mm-hmm. really overlook, it's just did or did you not get the money. But when you do a successful one, it's like getting a scholarship. Mm-hmm. You know, people invested in you. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of merit to that. There's mm-hmm. a lot of weight to that that goes just beyond you getting money you needed.
Yes. Yeah.
That's awesome. So you're here now. You're mm-hmm. kind of going through a little bit of a rebrand. You've just launched this, this third campaign. What are the next 3 years holding for you? What are your goals?
So we've actually... we've taken a bit of a pause on product development this year. We have tools that we have designs for that we would like to continue to manufacture, but we are at that phase of scaling and growth. Mm-hmm. And one of the things we realized is we're really great at launching and funding products. The Napier Jigger that we did last year, I think our goal was 15,000. I think our goal was 15,000 and we raised 58. And then we did another like 50 grand in pre-sales after the campaign ended.
Nice.
During the manufacturing window.
That's an incredible success. That's so wonderful.
It was something like, I think it was like $110,000 in pre-sales, which was really wonderful. And yet we're realizing that we've sort of, the business model that we do not want to continue is just having to release new products.
Right.
And having to crowdfund and always having, like, being beholden to that needing to always release something new. Because those ideas are special and we don't want to have necessarily 100 SKUs. Mm-hmm. We want to have the right number that produce exceptional tools.
Right. So you're going to scale.
So the scaling part is, how then do you continue to make sales of your product after you've initially launched your campaign? And I think we had to make a decision right after that very first campaign is, did we want to just be someone who launched a product, got it funded, great, or are we starting a business? And a lot of people, when they think about doing crowdfunding, it's because they have a specific idea that has a finite end point that they want to see come to life. And then it's hard to move that into the sustainable business phase where you have an ongoing customer base, ongoing sales. And that was a whole different learning curve, which we're still in the process of figuring out. So we took a break from product development because we said we need to like make sure we have everything else shored up, so that as we're launching new products, we know what to do with them after the fact.
Have you decided whether or not you will be going in physically into some or exclusive storefronts or just keeping it solely online? Are you still playing with that?
We are in, I'd say maybe a dozen specialty cocktail retail shops across the U.S.
Okay, so you're already in there.
Some in, of like maybe five or six international, like Australia and Dubai and Germany, the Northern Europe and Australia, like, really love our products. And so,
yeah.
But it doesn't make sense to really scale there yet. We've got to figure out our local market first. And so we have a wholesale program where we've done that, but then we also have an e-commerce store. And so we're direct to consumer. And so the biggest challenge that we're experiencing right now is, yes, you can have go B2C and you can go B2B at the same, you can be both, but not all at the same time.
Right. Yeah, that's absolutely true.
So the decision point right now is, do we pursue a B2B strategy or do we lean into the B2C strategy? And both of those paths have a lot of, like, pose a lot of questions to think about.
Do you have any mentors that you lean on when you're kind of weighing these things back and forth?
We do. And more so now than we did. I think that for the first few years, we were building a lot in isolation. Neither my husband, Sean, Michael, or I come from backgrounds where we have family that are in business or entrepreneurship, have any like foundational concepts of those.
Right.
And so it's been sort of hacking it together, learning from books, audiobooks, podcasts, YouTube.
But sure.
A lot of that in the early years was still very independently driven by us. And I've realized, especially after I have two children under the age of four.
Mm-hmm.
So that's all happened since we launched our initial product. Mm-hmm. That I need to surround myself with people who will tell me the way that it is, because isolation is one of the biggest enemies right now to forward progress.
Absolutely.
So
it's the opposite of connection, right?
Yeah.
Which is kind of what...
So that's one of the things that I've been focusing on this year, is pooling as many resources as I can from people who have been there, done that, or have unique perspectives that they can offer me. So when you ask if I have a mentor, I like immediately six or seven faces pop up in my brain, because I'm reaching out to everyone around me to learn as much as I can right now.
Well, then it will work. I think as long as you're determined to, you know, find someone... I think it's incredibly important. I think one of the things that I myself kind of lacked a clear path to is how important mentorship was, because once I bumped into it, you know, it's always altered my career, as well as all of those powerful female and female identified individuals I know. You know, I think it's used largely in the male communities that I was maybe not as involved with or excluded from, in backdoor ways that I didn't know about, you know, and so I was never taught this kind of mentorship, apprenticeship model that's so crucial for someone who doesn't go to business school or have, you know, a titan business mother.
Yes.
So,
yes.
So my final question for you is based on, so if you ran into a young woman or a female identified individual who was coming out of, you know, what she thought was going to be a 4-year education at Pitt, ended up being, you know, a couple years there, a year at sea, and then wrapping it up online, getting her handle into how she wanted to explore the business world, what are the top 3 pieces of advice you would give her to set out and to always keep about her?
If you don't already have people in your network who are entrepreneurs and who understand the journey, go make friends in that space. And I wish I had done that sooner.
Yeah.
Because a lot of that, those perspectives, find people who are at the stage that you're at, but also find people who are 1 and 2 and 10 steps ahead of you.
Yeah.
When you meet those people that are 10 steps ahead of you, don't compare yourself to them. Because everyone has a different journey and there's no one right way to do it.
Right.
But if you create an ecosystem of community around yourself where everyone is working through problems in tandem and with a certain level of vulnerability. I think in the startup community, there's a lot of presenting your best self, which isn't necessarily conducive to learning.
Yeah.
And so there's an aspect of vulnerability that you need to have when you're asking for help or just trying to learn from someone that you don't know. And I think that, oh gosh, there was a friend that, and I made a friend in this space, and I feel like we established really good rapport, and yet it was like 2 years later that we finally sort of opened up to one another about the reality of the businesses that we were trying to build.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my gosh, I did not know that you were dealing with these same challenges that I was dealing with, and we could have been working through those things together for the last 2 years.
Yeah, yeah. The candid relationship does go missing with an elevator pitch.
Yeah. And so it's, you know, it's meetups and finding a mentor. We have had unofficial and cursory mentors for the last few years. We currently have a formal mentor relationship with someone that's been extremely helpful. When you're looking for a mentor, it's got to be the right feeling and the right fit. One of the best things that I love about our mentor, even though he's got, oh gosh, 30 years of manufacturing expertise and has built incredibly big companies, the first question that he asked us was, where do you see yourselves in 10 years? What do you want out of this?
Right.
Because do you want to build an empire, or do you want to exit, or do you want to run your company and continue to do that and grow in the way that is most beneficial for you? Because what you want for your company is going to be different than what anyone else wants for your company.
Right.
And identifying that why will help you identify your path.
Yeah, absolutely. That's good advice. So, if you don't already have people in your network, make friends. Don't compare yourself with those ahead of you. And find a mentor.
Absolutely.
That's perfect.
The last thing, too, is if you haven't gotten started yet, just get started. Whatever that thing is that you've been putting off, like, do it today. Even if it's the tiniest thing, even if it's making a call to someone or doing the research that you've been putting off on the idea that you want. It's just like, just take the first step now.
Yeah, get going.
Thank yourself.
Absolutely, I agree. Well, we are all out of time. I wanna thank you so much, Rachel, for meeting with me today. I know you're busy, you got a lot on your plate, you got a young family, a young company, and a million things in between, and I'm So glad that you sat down with me, Jay. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for being such a gracious host. Absolutely. I feel like I was all over the place today.
No, but all over the place is the only way to go. So anyone who's looking to get information, you can hit Standard Spoon Barware at www.standardspoon.com.
That's us.
That's still there. Great. Mm-hmm. All the information and the products are up. It's a great site. I love it. You can kind of get a feel visually for everything we've been talking about here today, but you guys should hit it up. It's been great. For everyone listening, thank you so much for spending this time with us. And remember to always bet on yourself. Sláinte.